Important reason for both Jones's and Latimer's willingness to work so hard, though, was that Johnson worked still harder. When Jones trudged into the office at 5 in the morning, the lights would already be on, and Johnson would be hard at work. He was also the last to leave. He never asked his employees to do anything he wouldn't do himself. His energy was intense, boundless, and contagious. How could you let such a man down by working less hard than he did? Not only was Johnson relentlessly demanding, but his criticisms were often cruel. Occasionally, though, he would do Jones and Latimer some unexpected favor or praise them for something they hadn't realized he had noticed. At moments like this, the two young men quickly forgot the many bitter moments in their work. For Johnson, they felt, they would go to the ends of the earth. And indeed, Johnson rose through the ranks, first winning influence within Clayburgh's office, then gaining the attention of President Franklin D. Roosevelt himself. In 1935, Roosevelt named Johnson Texas State Director for the recently built National Youth Administration. Now, Johnson began to build a larger team around the core of his two devoted assistants. He also built loyalties in a scattering of others for whom he found jobs in Washington. The dynamic he had created with Jones and Latimer now repeated itself on a larger scale. Assistants competed for his attention, tried to please him, to meet his standards, to be worthy of him and of his causes. In 1937, when Congressman James Buchanan suddenly died, the seat for Texas's 10th district unexpectedly fell empty. Despite the incredible odds against him, he was still relatively unknown and way too young, Johnson decided to run and called in his chips. His carefully cultivated acolytes poured into Texas, becoming chauffeurs, canvassers, speechwriters, barbecue cooks, crowd entertainers, nurses, whatever the campaign needed. In the 6 short weeks of the race, Johnson's foot soldiers covered the length and breadth of the 10th district. And in front of them, at every step, was Johnson himself, campaigning as if his life depended on it. One by one, he and his team won over voters in every corner of the district. And finally, in one of the greatest upsets in any American political race, Johnson won the election. His later career, first as a senator, then as U.S. president, obscured the foundation of his first great success. The army of devoted and tireless followers that he had carefully built up over the previous 5 years. Interpretation. Lyndon Johnson was an intensely ambitious young man. He had neither money nor connections, but had something more valuable, an understanding of human psychology. To command influence in the world, you need a power base, and here human beings, a devoted army of followers, are more valuable than money. They will do things for you that money cannot buy. That army is tricky to build. People are contradictory and defensive. Push them too hard and they resent you. Treat them well and they take you for granted. Johnson avoided those traps by making his staff want his approval. To do that, he led from the front. He worked harder than any of his staff, and his men saw him do it. Failing to match him would have made them feel guilty and selfish. A leader who works that hard stirs competitive instincts in his men, who do all they can to prove themselves worthier than their teammates. By showing how much of his own time and effort he was willing to sacrifice, Johnson earned their respect. Once he had that respect, criticism, even when harsh, became an effective motivator, making his followers feel they were disappointing him. At the same time, some kind act out of the blue would break down any ability to resist him. Understand, morale is contagious, and you, as leader, set the tone. Ask for sacrifices you won't make yourself, doing everything through assistance, and your troops grow lethargic and resentful. Act too nice, show too much concern for their well-being, and you drain the tension from their souls and create spoiled children who whine at the slightest pressure or request for more work. Personal example is the best way to set the proper tone and build morale. When your people see your devotion to the cause, they ingest your spirit of energy and self-sacrifice. A few timely criticisms here and there, and they will only try harder to please you, to live up to your high standards. Instead of having to push and pull your army, you will find them chasing after you. 3. In May of 218 BC, the great general Hannibal of Carthage in modern Tunisia embarked on a bold plan. He would lead an army through Spain, Gaul, and across the Alps into northern Italy. His goal was to defeat Rome's legions on their own soil, finally putting an end to Rome's expansionist policies. The Alps were a tremendous obstacle to military advance. In fact, the march of an army across the high mountains was unprecedented. Yet in December of that year, after much hardship, Hannibal reached northern Italy, catching the Romans completely off guard and the region undefended. There was a price to pay, however. Of Hannibal's original 102,000 soldiers, a mere 26,000 survived, and they were exhausted, hungry, and demoralized. Worse, there was no time to rest. A Roman army was on its way and had already crossed the Po River, only a few miles from the Carthaginian camp. On the eve of his army's first battle with the fearsome Roman legions, Hannibal somehow had to bring his worn-out men alive. He decided to put on a show. Gathering his army together, he brought in a group of prisoners and told them that if they fought one another to the death in a gladiatorial contest, the victors would win freedom and a place in the Carthaginian army. The prisoners agreed, and Hannibal's soldiers were treated to hours of bloody entertainment, a great distraction from their troubles. When the fighting was over, Hannibal addressed his men. The contest had been so enjoyable, he said, because the prisoners had fought so intensely. That was partly because the weakest man grows fierce when losing means death. But there was another reason as well. They had the chance to join the Carthaginian army, to go from being abject prisoners to free soldiers fighting for a great cause, the defeat of the hated Romans. "You soldiers," said Hannibal, "are in exactly the same position. You face a much stronger enemy. You are many miles from home, on hostile territory, and you have nowhere to go. In a way, you are prisoners too. It is either freedom or slavery, victory or death. But fight as these men fought today, and you will prevail." The contest and speech got hold of Hannibal's soldiers, and the next day they fought with deadly ferocity and defeated the Romans. A series of victories against much larger Roman legions followed. Nearly 2 years later, the two sides met at Cannae. Before the battle, with the armies arrayed within sight of each other, the Carthaginians could see that they were hopelessly outnumbered, and fear passed through the ranks. Everyone went quiet. A Carthaginian officer named Gisco rode out in front of the men, taking in the Roman lines. Stopping before Hannibal, he remarked, with a quaver in his voice, on the disparity in numbers. "There is one thing, Gisco, that you have not noticed," Hannibal replied. "In all that great number of men opposite, there is not a single one whose name is Gisco." Gisco burst out laughing. So did those within hearing. And the joke passed through the ranks, breaking the tension. No, the Romans had no Gisco. Only the Carthaginians had Gisco. And only the Carthaginians had Hannibal. A leader who could joke at a moment like this had to feel supremely confident. And if the leader were Hannibal, that feeling was probably justified. Just as the troops had been swept with anxiety, now they were infected with self-assurance. At Cannae that day, in one of the most devastating victories in history, the Carthaginians crushed the Roman army. Interpretation. Hannibal was a master motivator of a rare kind. Where others would harangue their soldiers with speeches, he knew that to depend on words was to be in a sorry state. Words only hit the surface of a soldier, and a leader must grab his men's hearts, make their blood boil, get into their minds, alter their moods. Hannibal reached his soldiers' emotions indirectly by relaxing them, calming them, taking them outside their problems and getting them to bond. Only then did he hit them with a speech that brought home their precarious reality and swayed their emotions. At Canny, a one-line joke had the same effect. Instead of trying to persuade the troops of his confidence, Hannibal showed it to them. Even as they laughed at the joke about Gisco, they bonded over it and understood its inner meaning. No need for a speech. Hannibal knew that subtle changes in his men's mood could spell the difference between victory and defeat. Like Hannibal, you must aim indirectly at people's emotions. Get them to laugh or cry over something that seems unrelated to you or to the issue at hand. Emotions are contagious. They bring people together and make them bond. Then you can play them like a piano, moving them from one emotion to the other. Oratory and eloquent pleas only irritate and insult us. We see right through them. Motivation is subtler than that. By advancing indirectly, setting up your emotional appeal, you will get inside instead of just scratching the surface. 4. In the 1930s and 40s, the Green Bay Packers were one of the most successful teams in professional football. But by the late 50s, they were the worst. What went wrong? The team had many talented players, like the former All-American Paul Hornung. The owners cared about it deeply and kept hiring new coaches, new players, but nothing could slow the fall. The players tried. They hated losing. And really, they weren't that bad. They came close to winning many of the games they lost. So what could they do about it? The Packers hit bottom in 1958. For the 1959 season, they tried the usual trick, bringing in a new coach and general manager, Vince Lombardi. The players mostly didn't know much about the man, except that he had been an assistant coach for the New York Giants. As the players convened to meet the new coach, they expected the typical speech. "This is the year to turn things around. I'm going to get tough with you. No more business as usual." Lombardi did not disappoint them. In a quiet, forceful tone, he explained a new set of rules and code of conduct. But a few players noticed something different about Lombardi. He oozed confidence. No shouts, no demands. His tone and manner suggested that the Packers were already a winning team. They just had to live up to it. Was he an idiot or some kind of visionary? Then came the practices, and once again the difference was not so much how they were conducted as the spirit behind them. They felt different. They were shorter, but more physically demanding, almost to the point of torture. And they were intense, with the same simple plays endlessly repeated. Unlike other coaches, Lombardi explained what he was doing, installing a simpler system based not on novelty and surprise, but on efficient execution. The players had to concentrate intensely. The slightest mistake and they were doing extra laps, or making the whole team do extra laps. And Lombardi changed the drills constantly. The players were never bored and could never relax their mental focus. Earlier coaches had always treated a few players differently, the stars. They had a bit of an attitude, and they took off early and stayed up late. The other men had come to accept this as part of the pecking order, but deep down, they resented it. Lombardi, though, had no favorites. For him, there were no stars. "Coach Lombardi is very fair," said defensive tackle Henry Jordan. "He treats us all the same, like dogs." The players liked that. They enjoyed seeing Hornung yelled at and disciplined just as much as the others. Lombardi's criticisms were relentless and got under his players' skins. He seemed to know their weak points, their insecurities. How did he know, for instance, that Jordan hated to be criticized in front of the others? Lombardi exploited his fear of public lashings to make him try harder. "We were always trying to show Lombardi he was wrong," commented one player. That was his psyche. The practices grew more intense still. The players had never worked this hard in their lives, yet they found themselves showing up earlier and staying later. By the season's first game, Lombardi had prepared them for every contingency. Sick of training, They were grateful to be playing in a real game at last, and to their surprise, all that work made the game a lot easier. They were more prepared than the other team, and less tired in the fourth quarter. They won their first three games. With this sudden success, their morale and confidence soared. The Packers finished the year with a 7-5 record, a remarkable turnaround from 1958's 1-10-1. After one season under Lombardi, they had become the most tight-knit team in professional sports. No one wanted to leave the Packers. In 1960, they reached the championship game, and in 1961, they won it, with many more to follow. Over the years, various of Lombardi's Packers would try to explain how he had transformed them, but none of them could really say how he had pulled it off. Interpretation. When Vince Lombardi took over the Packers, he recognized the problem right away. The team was infected with adolescent defeatism. Teenagers will often strike a pose that is simultaneously rebellious and lackadaisical. It's a way of staying in place. Trying harder brings more risk of failure, which they cannot handle, so they lower their expectations, finding nobility in slacking off and mediocrity. Losing hurts less when they embrace it. Groups can get infected with this spirit without realizing it. All they need is a few setbacks, a few adolescent-minded individuals, and slowly, expectations lower and defeatism sets in. The leader who tries to change the group's spirit directly, yelling, demanding, disciplining, actually plays into the teenage dynamic and reinforces the desire to rebel. Lombardi was a motivational genius who saw everything in psychological terms. To him, the National Football League teams were virtually equal in talent. The differences lay in attitude and morale. Reversing the Packers' defeatism would translate into wins, which would lift their morale, which in turn would bring them more wins. Lombardi knew he had to approach his players indirectly, had to trick them into changing. He began with a show of confidence, talking as if he assumed they were winners who had fallen on bad times. That got under their skins, far more than they realized. Then, in his practices, Lombardi didn't make demands, a defensive, whiny approach that betrays insecurity. Instead, he changed the practice's spirit, making them quiet, intense, focused, workmanlike. He knew that willpower is tied to what you believe possible. Expand that belief, and you try harder. Lombardi created a better team, which won its first game, by making its players see possibilities. Defeat was no longer comfortable. Understand. A group has a collective personality that hardens over time, and sometimes that personality is dysfunctional or adolescent. Changing it is difficult. People prefer what they know, even if it doesn't work. If you lead this kind of group, do not play into its negative dynamic. Announcing intentions and making demands will leave people defensive and feeling like children. Like Lombardi, play the wily parent. Ask more of them. Expect them to work like adults. Quietly alter the spirit with which things are done. Emphasize efficiency. Anybody can be efficient. It isn't a question of talent. Efficiency breeds success, and success raises morale. Once the spirit and personality of the group start to shift, everything else will fall into place. 5. In April 1796, the 26-year-old Napoleon Bonaparte was named commander of the French forces fighting the Austrians in Italy. For many officers, his appointment was something of a joke. They saw their new leader as too short, too young, too inexperienced, and even too badly groomed to play the part of general. His soldiers, too, were underpaid, underfed, and increasingly disillusioned with the cause they were fighting for, the French Revolution. In the first few weeks of the campaign, Napoleon did what he could to make them fight harder, but they were largely resistant to him. On May 10th, Napoleon and his weary forces came to the bridge of Lodi over the River Adda. Despite his uphill struggle with his troops, He had the Austrians in retreat, but the bridge was a natural place to take a stand, and they had manned it with soldiers on either side and with well-placed artillery. Taking the bridge would be costly. But suddenly the French soldier saw Napoleon riding up in front of them, in a position of extreme personal risk, directing the attack. He delivered a stirring speech, then launched his grenadiers at the Austrian lines to cries of "Vive la République!" Caught up in the spirit, his senior officers led the charge. The French took the bridge, and now, after this relatively minor operation, Napoleon's troops suddenly saw him as a different man. In fond recognition of his courage, they gave him a nickname, Le Petit Caporal. The story of Napoleon facing the enemy at the Bridge of Lodi passed through the ranks. As the campaign wore on, and Napoleon won victory after victory, a bond developed between the soldiers and their general that went beyond mere affection. Between battles, Napoleon would sometimes wander among the soldiers' campfires, mingling with them. He himself had risen through the ranks, he had once been an ordinary gunner, and he could talk to the men as no other general could. He knew their names, their histories, even in what battles they'd been wounded. With some men, he would pinch an earlobe between his finger and thumb and give it a friendly tweak. Napoleon's soldiers did not see him often, but when they did, it was as if an electrical charge passed through them. It was not just his personal presence. He knew exactly when to show up, before a big battle, or when morale had slipped for some reason. At these moments, he would tell them they were making history together. If the squad were about to lead a charge or seemed in trouble, he would ride over and yell, 38th, I know you. Take me that village. At the charge. His soldiers felt they weren't just obeying orders. They were living out a great drama. Napoleon rarely showed anger, but when he did, his men felt worse than just guilty or upset. Late in the first Italian campaign, Austrian troops had forced some of his troops into a humiliating retreat for which there was no excuse. Napoleon visited their camp personally. "Soldiers, I am not satisfied with you," he told them, his large gray eyes seemingly on fire. "You have shown neither bravery, discipline, nor perseverance. You have allowed yourselves to be driven from positions where a handful of men could have stopped an army. Soldiers of the 39th and 85th, you are not French soldiers. General, Chief of Staff, let it be inscribed on their colors, they no longer form part of the army of Italy." The soldiers were astounded. Some cried. Others begged for another chance. They repented their weakness and turned completely around. The 39th and 85th would go on to distinguish themselves for strengths they had never shown previously. Some years later, during a difficult campaign against the Austrians in Bavaria, the French won a hard-fought victory. The next morning, Napoleon reviewed the 13th Regiment of Light Infantry, which had played a key role in the battle, and asked the colonel to name its bravest man. The colonel thought for a moment. "Sir, it is the drum major." Napoleon immediately asked to see the young bandsman, who appeared quaking in his boots. Then Napoleon announced loudly for everyone to hear, "They say that you are the bravest man in this regiment. I appoint you a Knight of the Legion of Honor, Baron of the Empire, and award you a pension of 4,000 francs. The soldiers gasped. Napoleon was famous for his well-timed promotions, and for promoting soldiers on merit, making even the lowliest private feel that if he proved himself he could someday be a marshal. But a drum major becoming a baron? Overnight? That was entirely beyond their experience. Word of it spread rapidly through the troops and had an electrifying effect, particularly on the newest conscripts, the ones who were most homesick and depressed. Throughout his long, very bloody campaigns, and even his heart-wrenching defeats, the bitter winter in Russia, the eventual exile to Elba, the final act at Waterloo, Napoleon's men would go to the ends of the earth for Le Petit Caporal and for no one else. Interpretation. Napoleon was the greatest man-manager in history. He took millions of unruly, undisciplined, unsoldierly young men, recently liberated by the French Revolution, and molded them into one of the most successful fighting forces ever known. Their high morale was all the more remarkable for the ordeals he put them through. Napoleon used every trick in the book to build his army. He united them around a cause, spreading first the ideas of the French Revolution, later the glory of France as a growing empire. He treated them well, but never spoiled them. He appealed not to their greed, but to their thirst for glory and recognition. He led from the front, proving his bravery again and again. He kept his men moving. There was always a new campaign for glory. Having bonded with them, he skillfully played on their emotions. More than soldiers fighting in an army, his men felt themselves part of a myth, united under the emperor's legendary eagle standards. Of all Napoleon's techniques, none was more effective than his use of punishments and rewards, all staged for the greatest dramatic impact. His personal rebukes were rare, but when he was angry, when he punished, the effect was devastating. The target felt disowned, outcast. As if exiled from the warmth of his family, he would struggle to win back the general's favor, and then never to give him a reason to be angry again. Promotions, rewards, and public praise were equally rare, and when they came, they were always for merit, never for some political calculation. Caught between the poles of wanting never to displease Napoleon and yearning for his recognition, his men were pulled into his sway, following him devotedly, but never quite catching up. Learn from the master. The way to manage people is to keep them in suspense. First, create a bond between your soldiers and yourself. They respect you, admire you, even fear you a little. To make the bond stronger, hold yourself back. Create a little space around you. You are warm, yet with a touch of distance. Once the bond is forged, appear less often. Make both your punishments and your praises rare and unexpected. Whether for mistakes or for successes that may seem minor at the time, but have symbolic meaning. Understand. Once people know what pleases you and what angers you, they turn into trained poodles, working to charm you with apparent good behavior. Keep them in suspense. Make them think of you constantly and want to please you but never know just how to do it. Once they are in the trap, you will have a magnetic pull over them. Motivation will become automatic. Reversal. If morale is contagious, so is its opposite. Fear and discontent can spread through your troops like wildfire. The only way to deal with them is to cut them off before they turn into panic and rebellion. In 58 BC, when Rome was fighting the Gallic War, Julius Caesar was preparing for battle against the Germanic leader Ariovistus. Rumors about the ferocity and size of the German forces were flying, and his army was panicky and mutinous. Caesar acted fast. First, he had the rumor mongers arrested. Next, he addressed his soldiers personally, reminding them of their brave ancestors who had fought and defeated the Germans. He would not lead their weaker descendants into battle. Since the 10th Legion alone seemed immune to the growing panic, he would take them alone. As Caesar prepared to march with the valiant 10th Legion, the rest of the army, ashamed, begged him to forgive them and let them fight. With a show of reluctance, he did so, and these once frightened men fought fiercely. In such cases, you must act like Caesar, turning back the tide of panic. Waste no time and deal with the whole group. People who spread panic or mutiny experience a kind of madness in which they gradually lose contact with reality. Appeal to their pride and dignity. Make them feel ashamed of their moment of weakness and madness. Remind them of what they have accomplished in the past and show them how they are falling short of the ideal. This social shaming will wake them up and reverse the dynamic. Here are further reflections on morale strategy. From Rules of War and Bravery by Mubarak Shah. You can do nothing with an army that is an amalgam of 100 people here, 100 people there, and so on. What can be achieved with 4,000 men united and standing shoulder to shoulder, you cannot do with 40 or even 400,000 men who are divided and pulled this way and that by internal conflicts. From King Henry V by William Shakespeare. What stronger breastplate than a heart untainted? Thrice is he armed that hath his quarrel just, and he but naked, though locked up in steel, whose conscience with injustice is corrupted. By Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. There are always moments when the commander's place is not back with his staff, but up with the troops. It is sheer nonsense to say that maintenance of the men's morale is the job of the battalion commander alone. The higher the rank, the greater the effect of the example. The men tend to feel no kind of contact with the commander who they know is sitting somewhere in headquarters. What they want is what might be termed a physical contact with him. In moments of panic, fatigue, or disorganization, or when something out of the ordinary has to be demanded from them, the personal example of the commander works wonders, especially if he has had the wit to create some sort of legend around himself. From Mastering the Art of War, Zhuge Liang's and Liu Ji's commentaries on the classic by Sun Tzu. During the spring and autumn era, the state of Qi was invaded by the states of Jin and Yan. At first, the invaders overcame the military forces of Qi. One of the eminent nobles of the court of Qi recommended the martialist Tian Rongju to the lord of Qi. To this man, later called Suma Rongju, is attributed the famous military handbook, Suma's Art of War. The lord of Qi then summoned Rongju to discuss military matters with him. The lord was very pleased with what Rongju had to say, and he made him a general, appointing him to lead an army to resist the aggression of the forces of Yan and Jin. Rongju said, "I am lowly in social status, yet the Lord has promoted me from the ranks and placed me above even the grandees. The soldiers are not yet loyal to me, and the common people are not familiar with me. As a man of little account, my authority is slight. I request one of your favorite ministers, someone honored by the state, to be overseer of the army." The Lord acceded to this request and appointed a nobleman to be the overseer. Rongju took his leave, arranging to meet the nobleman at the military headquarters at noon the following day. Then Rongju hastened back to set up a sundial and a water clock to await the new overseer. Now this new overseer was a proud and haughty aristocrat, and he imagined that as overseer he was leading his own army. Because of his pride and arrogance, he did not see any need to hurry, in spite of his promise with Rongju, the martial master. His relatives and close associates gave him a farewell party, and he stayed to drink with them. At noon the next day, the new overseer had not arrived at headquarters. Rongju took down the sundial and emptied the water clock. He assembled the troops and informed them of the agreement with the new overseer. That evening, the nobleman finally arrived. Rongju said to him, "Why are you late?" He said, "My relatives, who are grandees, gave me a farewell party, so I stayed for that." Rongju said, "On the day a military leader receives his orders, he forgets about his home. When a promise is made in the face of battle, one forgets his family. When the war drums sound, one forgets his own body. Now hostile states have invaded our territory. The state is in an uproar. The soldiers are exposed at the borders. The Lord cannot rest or enjoy his food. The lives of the common people all depend on you. How can you talk about farewell parties?" Rongju then summoned the officer in charge of military discipline and asked him, "According to military law, what happens to someone who arrives later than an appointed time?" The officer replied, "He is supposed to be decapitated." Terrified, the aristocrat had a messenger rush back to report this to the Lord and beseech him for help. But the haughty nobleman was executed before the messenger even returned, and his execution was announced to the army. The soldiers all shook with fear. Eventually, the Lord sent an emissary with a letter pardoning the nobleman, who was, after all, the new overseer of the army. The emissary galloped right into camp on horseback with the Lord's message. Rongju said, "When a general is in the field, there are orders he doesn't take from the ruler." He also said to the disciplinary officer, "It is a rule that there shall be no galloping through camp, yet now the emissary has done just that. What should be done with him?" The officer said, "He should be executed." The emissary was petrified, but Rongju said, "It is not proper to kill an emissary of the Lord," and had two of the emissary's attendants executed in his stead. This, too, was announced to the army. Rongju sent the emissary back to report to the Lord, and then he set out with the army. When the soldiers made camp, Rongju personally oversaw the digging of wells, construction of stoves, preparation of food and drink, and care of the sick. He shared all of the supplies of the leadership with the soldiers, personally eating the same rations as they. He was especially kind to the weary and weakened. After 3 days, Rongju called the troops to order. Even those who were ill wanted to go along, eager to go into battle for Rongju. When the armies of Jin and Yan heard about this, they withdrew from the state of Qi. Now Rongju led his troops to chase them down and strike them. Eventually, he recovered lost territory and returned with the army victorious. From Aesop's Fables. The Wolves and the Dogs at War. One day, enmity broke out between the dogs and the wolves. The dogs elected a Greek to be their general, but he was in no hurry to engage in battle, despite the violent intimidation of the wolves. "Understand," he said to them, "why I deliberately put off engagement. It is because one must always take counsel before acting. The wolves, on the one hand, are all of the same race, all of the same color. But our soldiers have very varied habits, and each one is proud of his own country. Even their colors are not uniform. Some are black, some russet, and others white or ash gray. How can I lead into battle those who are not in harmony and who are all dissimilar? In all armies, it is unity of will and purpose which assures victory over the enemy." By Colonel Charles Saint-Antoine. Hannibal was the greatest general of antiquity by reason of his admirable comprehension of the morale of combat, of the morale of the soldier, whether his own or the enemy's. He shows his greatness in this respect in all the different incidents of war, of campaign, of action. His men were not better than the Roman soldiers. They were not as well armed, one half less in number. Yet he was always the conqueror. He understood the value of morale. He had the absolute confidence of his people. In addition, he had the art, in commanding an army, of always securing the advantage of morale. By Colonel Charles Ardent-Dupic. Four brave men who do not know each other will not dare to attack a lion. Four less brave, but knowing each other well, sure of their reliability, and consequently of mutual aid, will attack resolutely. There is the science of the organization of armies in a nutshell. From the Iliad by Homer. The Greeks met the Trojans without a tremor. Agamemnon ranged among them, commanding, "Be men, my friends, fight with valor and with a sense of shame before your comrades. You're less likely to be killed with a sense of shame. Running away never won glory or a fight." From The Red Badge of Courage by Stephen Crane. He suddenly lost concern for himself and forgot to look at a menacing fate. He became not a man, but a member. He felt that something of which he was a part, a regiment, an army, a cause, or a country, was in a crisis. He was welded into a common personality, which was dominated by a single desire. For some moments he could not flee, no more than a little finger can commit a revolution from a hand. There was a consciousness always of the presence of his comrades about him. He felt the subtle battle brotherhood more potent even than the cause for which they were fighting. It was a mysterious fraternity, born of the smoke and danger of death. From King Henry V by William Shakespeare. Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect. Let it pry through the portage of the head like the brass cannon. Let the brow o'erwhelm it as fearfully as doth a galled rock o'erhang and jutty his confounded base, swilled with the wild and wasteful ocean. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard to the breath and bend up every spirit to his full height. On, on, you noblest English, whose blood is fet from fathers of war-proof. Fathers that, like so many Alexanders, have in these parts from morn till even fought and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. Now attest that those whom you called fathers did beget you. Be copy now to men of grosser blood, and teach them how to war. And you, good yeomen, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not. For there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon this charge cry, God for Harry, England, and St. George. From The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. Mercenary and auxiliary arms are useless and dangerous, and if one keeps his state founded on mercenary arms, one will never be firm or secure, for they are disunited, ambitious, without discipline, unfaithful, bold among friends, among enemies, cowardly. No fear of God, no faith with men. Ruin is postponed only as long as attack is postponed. And in peace you are despoiled by them, in war by the enemy. The cause of this is that they have no love nor cause to keep them in the field other than a small stipend, which is not sufficient to make them want to die for you. And lastly, by Frederick the Great. If you wish to be loved by your soldiers, husband their blood, and do not lead them to slaughter. Part 3. Defensive Warfare. To fight in a defensive manner is not a sign of weakness. It is the height of strategic wisdom, a powerful style of waging war. Its requirements are simple. First, you must make the most of your resources, fighting with perfect economy, and engaging only in battles that are necessary. Second, you must know how and when to retreat, luring an aggressive enemy into an imprudent attack. Then, waiting patiently for his moment of exhaustion, launch a vicious counterattack. In a world that frowns on displays of overt aggression, the ability to fight defensively, to let others make the first move and then wait for their own mistakes to destroy them, will bring you untold power. Because you waste neither energy nor time, you are always ready for the next inevitable battle. Your career will be long and fruitful. To fight this way, you must master the arts of deception. By seeming weaker than you are, you can draw the enemy into an ill-advised attack. By seeming stronger than you are, perhaps through an occasional act that is reckless and bold, you can deter the enemy from attacking you. In defensive warfare, you are essentially leveraging your weaknesses and limitations into power and victory. The following four chapters will instruct you in the basic arts of defensive warfare: economy of means, counterattack, intimidation and deterrence, and how to retreat skillfully and lie low when under aggressive attack. Chapter 8. Pick your battles carefully. The perfect economy strategy. We all have limitations. Our energies and skills will take us only so far. Danger comes from trying to surpass our limits. Seduced by some glittering prize into overextending ourselves, we end up exhausted and vulnerable. You must know your limits and pick your battles carefully. Consider the hidden costs of a war. Time lost, political goodwill squandered, an embittered enemy bent on revenge. Sometimes it is better to wait, to undermine your enemies covertly rather than hitting them straight on. If battle cannot be avoided, get them to fight on your terms. Aim at their weaknesses. Make the war expensive for them and cheap for you. Fighting with perfect economy, you can outlast even the most powerful foe. The Spiral Effect. In 281 BC, war broke out between Rome and the city of Tarentum on Italy's east coast. Tarentum had begun as a colony of the Greek city of Sparta. Its citizens still spoke Greek, considered themselves cultured Spartans, and thought other Italian cities barbaric. Rome, meanwhile, was an emerging power, locked in a series of wars with neighboring cities. The prudent Romans were reluctant to take on Tarentum. It was Italy's wealthiest city at the time, rich enough to finance its allies in a war against Rome. It was also too far away, off in the southeast, to pose an immediate threat. But the Tarentines had sunk some Roman ships that had wandered into their harbor, killing the fleet's admiral, and when Rome had tried to negotiate a settlement, its ambassadors had been insulted. Roman honor was at stake, and it readied itself for war. Tarentum had a problem. It was wealthy, but had no real army. Its citizens had gotten used to easy living. The solution was to call in a Greek army to fight on its behalf. The Spartans were otherwise occupied, so the Tarentines called on King Pyrrhus of Epirus, 319 to 272 BC, the greatest Greek warrior king since Alexander the Great. Epirus was a small kingdom in west-central Greece. It was a poor land, sparsely populated, with meager resources, but Pyrrhus, raised on stories of Achilles, from whom his family claimed to be descended, and of Alexander the Great, a distant cousin, was determined to follow in the footsteps of his illustrious ancestors and relatives, expanding Epirus and carving out his own empire. As a young man, he had served in the armies of other great military men, including Ptolemy, a general of Alexander's who now ruled Egypt. Pyrrhus had quickly proved his value as a warrior and leader. In battle, he had become known for leading dangerous charges, earning himself the nickname the Eagle. Back in Epirus, he had built up a small army and trained it well, even managing to defeat the much larger Macedonian army in several battles. Pyrrhus's reputation was on the rise, but it was hard for a small country like his to gain ascendancy over more powerful Greek neighbors like the Macedonians, the Spartans, and the Athenians. And the Tarentines' offer was tempting. First, they promised him money and a large army raised from allied states. Second, by defeating the Romans, he could make himself master of Italy. And from Italy, he could take first Sicily, then Carthage in North Africa. Alexander had moved east to create his empire. Pyrrhus could move west and dominate the Mediterranean. He accepted the offer. In the spring of 280 BC, Pyrrhus set sail with the largest Greek army ever to cross into Italy. 20,000 foot soldiers, 3,000 horsemen, 2,000 bowmen, and 20 elephants. Once in Tarentum, though, he realized he had been tricked. Not only did the Tarentines have no army, they had made no effort to assemble one, leaving Pyrrhus to do it himself. Pyrrhus wasted no time. He declared a military dictatorship in the city and began to build and train an army from among the Tarentines as fast as possible. Pyrrhus's arrival in Tarentum worried the Romans, who knew his reputation as a strategist and fighter. Deciding to give him no time to prepare, they quickly sent out an army, forcing Pyrrhus to make do with what he had, and he set off to face them. The two armies met near the town of Heraclea. Pyrrhus and his troops were outnumbered and at one point were on the verge of defeat when he unleashed his secret weapon. His elephants, with their massive weight, loud, fearsome trumpeting, and soldiers on top, firing arrows down at will. The Romans had never faced elephants in battle before, and panic spread among them, turning the tide of the fight. Soon, the disciplined Roman legions were in headlong retreat. The eagle had won a great victory. His fame spread across the Italian peninsula. He was indeed the reincarnation of Alexander the Great. Now other cities sent him reinforcements, more than making up for his losses at Heraclea. But Pyrrhus was worried. He had lost many veterans in the battle, including key generals. More important, the strength and discipline of the Roman legions had impressed him. They were like no other troops he had faced. He decided to try to negotiate a peaceful settlement with the Romans, offering to share the peninsula with them. At the same time, though, he marched on Rome to give the negotiations urgency and to make it clear that unless the Romans sued for peace, they would face him again. Meanwhile, the defeat at Heraclea had had a powerful effect on the Romans, who were not easily intimidated and did not take defeat lightly. Immediately after the battle, a call went out for recruits, and young men responded in droves. The Romans proudly rejected the offer of a settlement. They would never share Italy. The two armies met again near the town of Asculum, not far from Rome, in the spring of 279 BC. This time their numbers were about equal. The first day of battle was fierce, and once again the Romans seemed to have the edge, but on the second day Pyrrhus, a strategic master, managed to lure the Roman legions onto terrain better suited to his own style of maneuvering, and he gained the advantage. As was his wont, near the end of the day, he personally led a violent charge at the heart of the Roman legions, elephants in front. The Romans scattered, and Pyrrhus was once again victorious. King Pyrrhus had now scaled the heights, yet he felt only gloom and foreboding. His losses had been terrible. The ranks of the generals he depended on were decimated, and he himself had been badly wounded. At the same time, the Romans seemed inexhaustible, undaunted by their defeat. When congratulated on his victory at Asculum, he replied, "If we defeat the Romans in one more such battle, we shall be totally ruined." Pyrrhus, however, was already ruined. His losses at Asculum were too large to be quickly replaced, and his remaining forces were too few to fight the Romans again. His Italian campaign was over. Interpretation. From the story of King Pyrrhus and his famous lament after the Battle of Asculum comes the expression Pyrrhic victory, signifying a triumph that is as good as a defeat, for it comes at too great a cost. The victor is too exhausted to exploit his win, too vulnerable to face the next battle. And indeed, after the victory at Asculum, Pyrrhus staggered from one disaster to the next, his army never quite strong enough to defeat his growing hosts of enemies. This culminated in his untimely death in battle, ending Epirus's hopes to become a power in Greece. Pyrrhus could have avoided this downward spiral. Advance intelligence would have told him about both the disciplined ferocity of the Romans and the decadence and treachery of the Tarentines. And knowing this, he could have taken more time to build an army or canceled the expedition altogether. Once he saw that he had been tricked, he could have turned back. After Heraclea, there would still be time to retrench, consolidate, quit while he was ahead. Had he done any of this, his story might have had a different ending. But Pyrrhus could not stop himself. The dream was too alluring. Why worry about the costs? He could recover later. One more battle, one more victory would seal the deal. Pyrrhic victories are much more common than you might think. Excitement about a venture's prospects is natural before it begins, and if the goal is enticing, we unconsciously see what we want to see. More of the possible gains, fewer of the possible difficulties. The further we go, the harder it becomes to pull back and rationally reassess the situation. In such circumstances, the costs tend not just to mount, they spiral out of control. If things go badly, we get exhausted, which leads us to make mistakes, which lead to new, unforeseen problems, which in turn lead to new costs. Any victories we might have along the way are meaningless. Understand, the more you want the prize, the more you must compensate by examining what getting it will take. Look beyond the obvious costs and think about the intangible ones. The goodwill you may squander by waging war. The fury of the loser if you win. The time that winning may take. Your debt to your allies. You can always wait for a better time. You can always try something more in line with your resources. Remember, history is littered with the corpses of people who ignored the costs. Save yourself unnecessary battles and live to fight another day. From The Art of War by Sun Tzu. When the weapons have grown dull and spirits depressed, when our strength has been expended and resources consumed, then others will take advantage of our exhaustion to arise. Then, even if you have wise generals, you cannot make things turn out well in the end. Strengths and Weaknesses. When Elizabeth I, 1533-1603, ascended the throne of England in 1558, she inherited a second-rate power. The country had been racked by civil war, and its finances were in a mess. Elizabeth dreamed of creating a long period of peace in which she could slowly rebuild England's foundations, and particularly its economy. A government with money was a government with options. England, a small island with limited resources, could not hope to compete in war with France and Spain, the great powers of Europe. Instead, it would gain strength through trade and economic stability. Year by year, for 20 years, Elizabeth made progress. Then, in the late 1570s, her situation suddenly seemed dire. An imminent war with Spain threatened to cancel all the gains of the previous 2 decades. The Spanish king, Philip II, was a devout Catholic who considered it his personal mission to reverse the spread of Protestantism. The Low Countries, now Holland and Belgium, were properties of Spain at the time, but a growing Protestant rebellion was threatening its rule, and Philip went to war with the rebels, determined to crush them. Meanwhile, his most cherished dream was to restore Catholicism to England. His short-term strategy was a plot to have Elizabeth assassinated and then to place her half-sister, the Catholic Mary Queen of Scots, on the British throne. In case this plan failed, his long-term strategy was to build an immense armada of ships and invade England. Philip did not keep his intentions well hidden, and Elizabeth's ministers saw war as inevitable. They advised her to send an army to the Low Countries, forcing Philip to put his resources there instead of into an attack on England. But Elizabeth balked at that idea. She would send small forces there to help the Protestant rebels avert a military disaster, but she would not commit to anything more. Elizabeth dreaded war. Maintaining an army was a huge expense, and all sorts of other hidden costs were sure to emerge, threatening the stability she had built up. If war with Spain really was inevitable, Elizabeth wanted to fight on her own terms. She wanted a war that would ruin Spain financially and leave England safe. Defying her ministers, Elizabeth did what she could to keep the peace with Spain, refusing to provoke Philip. That bought her time to put aside funds for building up the British Navy. Meanwhile, she worked in secret to damage the Spanish economy, which she saw as its only weak spot. Spain's enormous, expanding empire in the New World made it powerful, but that empire was far away. To maintain it and profit from it, Philip was entirely dependent on shipping, a vast fleet that he paid for with enormous loans from Italian bankers. His credit with these banks depended on the safe passage of his ships bringing gold from the New World. The power of Spain rested on a weak foundation. And so Queen Elizabeth unleashed her greatest captain, Sir Francis Drake, on the Spanish treasure ships. He was to appear to be operating on his own, a pirate out for his own profit. No one was to know of the connection between him and the Queen. With each ship that he captured, the interest rate on Philip's loans crept upward, until eventually the Italian bankers were raising the rate more because of the threat of Drake than because of any specific loss. Philip had hoped to launch his armada against England by 1582. Short of money, he had to delay. Elizabeth had bought herself more time. Meanwhile, much to the chagrin of Philip's finance ministers, the king refused to scale back the size of the invading armada. Building it might take longer, but he would just borrow more money. Seeing his fight with England as a religious crusade, he would not be deterred by mere matters of finance. While working to ruin Philip's credit, Elizabeth put an important part of her meager resources into building up England's spy network. In fact, she made it the most sophisticated intelligence agency in Europe. With agents throughout Spain, she was kept informed of Philip's every move. She knew exactly how large the armada was to be and when it was to be launched. That allowed her to postpone calling up her army and reserves until the very last moment, saving the government money. Finally, in the summer of 1588, the Spanish armada was ready. It comprised 128 ships, including 20 large galleons, and a vast number of sailors and soldiers. Equal in size to England's entire navy, it had cost a fortune. The armada set sail from Lisbon in the second week of July. But Elizabeth's spies had fully informed her of Spain's plans, and she was able to send a fleet of smaller, more mobile English ships to harass the armada on its way up the French coast, sinking its supply ships and generally creating chaos. As the commander of the English fleet, Lord Howard of Effingham reported, "Their force is wonderful great and strong, and yet we pluck their feathers little by little." Finally, the armada came to anchor in the port of Calais, where it was to link up with the Spanish armies stationed in the Low Countries. Determined to prevent it from picking up these reinforcements, the English gathered 8 large ships, loaded them with flammable substances, and set them on course for the Spanish fleet, which was anchored in tight formation. As the British ships approached the harbor under full sail, their crews set them on fire and evacuated. The result was havoc, with dozens of Spanish ships in flames. Others scrambled for safe water, often colliding with one another. In their haste to put to sea, all order broke down. The loss of ships and supplies at Calais devastated Spanish discipline and morale, and the invasion was called off. To avoid further attacks on the return to Spain, the remaining ships headed not south, but north, planning to sail home around Scotland and Ireland. The English did not even bother with pursuit. They knew that the rough weather in those waters would do the damage for them. By the time the shattered armada returned to Spain, 44 of its ships had been lost, and most of the rest were too damaged to be seaworthy. Almost 2/3 of its sailors and soldiers had perished at sea. Meanwhile, England had lost not a single ship, and barely 100 men had died in action. It was a great triumph, but Elizabeth wasted no time on gloating. To save money, she immediately decommissioned the navy. She also refused to listen to advisers who urged her to follow up her victory by attacking the Spanish in the Low Countries. Her goals were limited: to exhaust Philip's resources and finances, forcing him to abandon his dreams of Catholic dominance and instituting a delicate balance of power in Europe. And this, indeed, was ultimately her greatest triumph, for Spain never recovered financially from the disaster of the Armada, and soon gave up its designs on England altogether. Interpretation. The defeat of the Spanish Armada has to be considered one of the most cost-effective in military history. A second-rate power that barely maintained a standing army was able to face down the greatest empire of its time. What made the victory possible was the application of a basic military axiom: attack their weaknesses with your strengths. England's strengths were its small, mobile navy and its elaborate intelligence network. Its weaknesses were its limited resources in men, weaponry, and money. Spain's strengths were its vast wealth and its huge army and fleet. Its weaknesses were the precarious structure of its finances, despite their magnitude, and the lumbering size and slowness of its ships. Elizabeth refused to fight on Spain's terms, keeping her army out of the fray. Instead, she attacked Spain's weaknesses with her strengths, plaguing the Spanish galleons with her smaller ships, wreaking havoc on the country's finances, using special ops to grind its war machine to a halt. She was able to control the situation by keeping England's costs down, while making the war effort more and more expensive.